Anita, how's your mental health?
Questionable at all times, you know this.
Yeah, how's the mental health of your children?
Also a little bit tricky. Can I tell you my experience in trying to find therapists for myself and my kids, Mel?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is how it goes. You ask around your friends and your family for a referral for somebody who's nearby. You finally find somebody who sounds like they might work for your family. You give them a call and you find out that A, they're not accepting new patients, or B, they have a huge wait list. So you start over again and you ask people if they know anybody who would be a good therapist and a good fit. Finally, you find one, you go and you meet with them, and you figure out that you don't actually like them that much. But it's been so much work to find somebody who you can go to in your area that you're kind of stuck with them. Well, do you have any ideas for how to get around this?
I do because guess what? I've actually had some therapists that I have found on my own, which involves what you're saying. Sometimes I remember one time I was like 3 hours in the bathtub on my phone looking through websites. I was such a prune at the end. But I have also had the experience with working with BetterHelp, and it was like I don't want to say too good to be true, but because it is true, but it's like amazing because I was matched with my therapist within 24 hours.
And you didn't have to go through all of that other ridiculous process of trying to find somebody. And here's the cool thing, too, is if that person didn't work out for you, you can just switch and say, and it's not like you're committing to another years long search for somebody who you're going to jive with.
That's true. And I lucked out, or maybe just BetterHelp is really good at matching people together because I never had to change my therapist. I loved her, perfect fit for me. And I know that some of our friends have used BetterHelp and they've had to change therapists, and boom, same day, you can change.
Easy
You can ghost your therapist, get a
peasy.
new one.
I love this idea. BetterHelp is one of our sponsors. If you use our promo code trybetterhelp.com/WWDN, you get 10% off your first month, and we totally recommend it.
Yes, get some therapy. That's
Ha.
trybetterhelp.com/WWDN.
I think you're gonna like this interview so much, Mel.
Good. I only know a little bit about maybe what we're going to talk about, so I am excited if it's what I think it is.
Yes. Do you want to tell us who you are, dear guest?
Sure. I'm Lori Tucker Sullivan. I'm a writer and educator in Detroit, and I have a book coming out shortly. And that book is about my experience spending, gosh, going on 7 years now, tracking down the widows of rock stars who, most of whom died young or left young widows. And they have become my grief group, my tribe, my friends. And it's just been an amazing experience. And they are the most amazing women I've ever met. And the fact that this has never been done before just completely surprises me. But yeah, that's me.
First of all, Detroit, there's something in the water in Detroit where there are so many good musicians. I'm a musician and a widow, so I'm so curious to hear what you talk about. How did you decide to get into this? Are you a widow or are you mostly a writer?
I'm both. I am a widow. My husband Kevin passed away in 2010 after about 3 years with squamous cell carcinoma, head and neck cancer.
What?
I
Okay, we were just talking.
had just talking about that, and I was being rather
Yeah.
blasé about it. Turns out I needed to take it more seriously. Sorry.
Nice,
Yes,
Anita.
yes. And I had started out actually as a music writer early on, interned for a little bit at a music magazine, and you know, music in Detroit, you can't grow up in Detroit without music being a part of your life. You know, I'm not a musician. My husband wasn't a musician either, but it was a big part of our lives. And I had always thought I'd be a musician. And then we met in college. We married while we were still in college. About a year after we met, we found an old abandoned farmhouse and we started renovating it. And so I kind of set aside the dreams of being a music writer and, you know, following some band around on tour and things like that. And went the route of, you know, wife, mom, home renovator, all of those wonderful things. And And always kind of wanted to get back to writing and didn't really come back to it until around 2006, 2007. I knew that I had had this kind of unhappiness, this little layer of unhappiness in my life, kind of through our marriage. And, you know, we had a big kind of talk about it. And I said, I think I really need to kind of start writing again and devote some more time to it. And I'd had some interest actually in a piece that I had written about my grandmother. And so I said, I'm going back to school, I'm going to get my MFA, and I'm going to start writing full time. And my husband was very supportive of that. And so I was halfway through the MFA program when he was diagnosed. And so I made it through another semester, but then everything, you know, was put on hold. And so I promised him that however things turned out, I would finish my degree. I wouldn't put it, you know, on the shelf for a long time. And so after he passed away in September of 2010. And in November, I went back to school. And I was driving, I was in a low residency program in Louisville, Kentucky. So I was driving from Detroit to Louisville. And I heard a story about Yoko Ono. And I said, this is it. This is who I need to be writing about. My grief therapist had suggested that I kind of form my own grief group. I told her the grief groups I had attended weren't quite doing it for me. I had just in a couple of years' time, I had lost Kevin, both my parents, close friends, our minister. We just had a lot of stuff. I sold the farmhouse that we had renovated because it was just really too much for me to take on. My kids went off to school, you know, high school and college. So I wasn't really in the mom role as much as I had been. And so, you know, I said, really, all of the ways in which I used to identify myself are gone. And so I need more than just this regular kind of grief group. I honor the losses of, you know, these people that I've been talking to, but I need something more than this. And she had kind of planted the seed that I should, you know, make my own. And I decided then that that was it. That was my group.
How old were you when you were widowed? And how old were your kids?
So I was 46. Kevin was about 6 weeks away from his 50th birthday. And my son was in his first week of college, mm-hmm. and my daughter was in middle school. Okay. So you know, daughter's heading into high school, and my son's going away to college. And so, yeah, so much of how I kind of identified myself was changing or gone. And I just wanted to talk to women who had been through that and who came out on the other side. And so we ended up, I got together with some friends and we went to the bar after class that night, as we sometimes did. and sitting there with my laptop, I said, if I can make a list of like 8 or 10 of these women that look pretty interesting, I think I'm going to do this. And we had a list of like 22 in you know, pretty quick time.
Yeah.
And who had, you know, had died before the age of 30 or 35. And had been married. And then I started reading the women's stories and said, this is it. Like these, how can we not know about these women? It just was completely surprising to me. So I started it really as a project just to meet them and talk to them. And I was writing about it, but I didn't know if it would be a book. You know, I didn't have a publisher that was interested. I put together a proposal and we kind of sent it out. I had worked for several years in bookselling. And so I was adjacent to publishing, had some connections, had lots of people that helped out a little bit and believed in the project. But I knew I had to, you know, write about these women and whatever form it eventually took. And then I did get a publishing deal about 3 years in. So, yeah.
I want to hear the pitch when you contacted the people and how did you contact them? I mean, some of this was kind of before the days of Instagram DMs. Like, how did you find them? They tend to hide, I feel like.
Some of them I just searched online and found addresses and wrote handwritten letters. And a few days later, they'd call me and say, yes, I want to talk to you. The first one I heard back from was Gloria Jones, and I had reached out to Gloria on Facebook, She was the widow of, is the widow of Mark Bolan from T-Rex. And, you know, T-Rex, their big song was Bang a Gong in the 70s. And and I read about Gloria and this, you know, this life that she was living. She had moved to Sierra Leone, West Africa, after a few years after his passing, and started the Mark Bolan School of Music and Film in Sierra Leone. And wow. So I thought, you know, I need to talk to this person. So I sent her a note on Facebook, and a few days later I get this phone call, and there's this long string of numbers on my phone. I'm thinking, what is this? And I answer it, and she said, "Lori, it's Gloria. I'm coming to LA. Meet me." So I said, okay, let's set a date. And I met her at a hotel, and she just grabbed me by the hand, and we went down Sunset, and we went to the Troubadour and the Roxy and the Rainbow Room. And she just told me all about this time with, you know, this is where we sat with John Lennon, and over here was Harry Nilsson, and, you know, David Bowie would come up, and we'd drive down from, we had a house in Beverly Canyon, and we'd drive down in Mark's gold Cadillac. And it was just so, like, I could do this forever, like, just to listen to these stories and to kind of, you know, live what I had thought I would do in my 20s, you know, I'm kind of doing now vicariously. And you know, I said a few months ago, I delivered a sermon, which was something I never thought I would do, but I wrote it up, and I said at the end that I wasn't supposed to write about musicians. Now I realize in my life, I was supposed to write about love. And that's what, I mean, just the love that these people shared, what these women have gone through, how dedicated they've been, how much and how hard they work to preserve legacies. It's just, yeah, the stories are just really, really special. So, and that's how it started. Once I talked to Gloria, I knew that, you know, I was onto something really wonderful. And she had, you know, she was driving the car, and they had an accident, and Mark was killed instantly. She was hospitalized. She had been a backup singer. She had, you know, worked at Motown. They had a son, and Roland was like 2 years old, 2.5. And by the time she got out of the hospital, they had already held Mark's funeral. She was unconscious for several days, and so she had no idea what, you know, had gone on. And then she went home, and her home had been looted, and everything was gone. Everything. Fans had gotten in, and who knows what happens. It's still kind of a mystery. Mark had kind of tied up his finances in the Bahamas. He had an outdated will. Gloria was listed as his personal secretary, and so she was left about £10,000, and that was it. So it was just a struggle, you know, for her for years and years and years. And that's, you know, there more than one time I've talked to a woman who was living in a beautiful, large home one day and homeless within a few days, because there's a prenup that isn't good, or there are children from a previous marriage, or it's just, yeah, the stories are just, every one of them is, you know, some of them are just sweet and wonderful love affairs, and then, you know, dealing with grief afterwards. But many of them are wild and crazy.
It's so fascinating, because I've thought about this from time to time since becoming a widow. I've thought of what it would be like. You mentioned Yoko, you know, earlier when we were talking, for somebody like Yoko, where it's like, you know, in some way was so hated by so many people because they were like, she broke up the Beatles, this and that. Of course, she was John's person, and then he dies in such a huge way, you know, one of the most iconic musicians of all time. And of course, I didn't think about that until I became a widow, where I was like, how is she? She's probably going through, you know, of course, going through similar things like we all are, but like on that level of popularity or just being well known, what a nightmare that could be. Or those things like you mentioned, fans looting, you know, nobody's going to come loot mine and Anita's house. because we have nothing.
Suckers.
But yeah, it's so, I'm really happy. And I mean, it's sad that there are stories like in that vein, but I'm really happy that you're sharing those with the world, because who's going to talk about them? It's interesting because with guys like Paul McCartney, he was a widower, like in what, 1999, but then he gets remarried. But it's like, you kind of think of celebrities as not normal people, but they are. They're real people and they have feelings and everything like that. And then they're on this other level.
Every story was, you know, just interesting, you know, lovely in parts, terribly sad. All of them have had these, you know, kind of run-ins with fans, and they can't do anything right. Mary Kawaguchi was the girlfriend of Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And she was telling me about how they flew back to England. You know, she and Keith were living in LA, but they flew back to England and they had his funeral there, and he was buried there, and it was the middle of winter. And so they couldn't put any kind of marker on his grave because ground settles over, you know, over the seasons. And so they want you to wait until spring. And fans are online berating her. How can you leave his grave like this, unmarked in this way? And, you know, they don't, people don't think about it. And it is everything they do, just, you know, they have to face such scrutiny. And it's, you know, you and I, you know, we did not go through that. We made our own decisions. We maybe consulted, you know, family, but it's not up to fans who think that they kind of, you know, own a piece of this person.
Sometimes we assume that unless we had a huge life insurance payout, we don't really need to know anything about investments or even finances. But guess what? A little knowledge of finances is critical for all of us. Maybe your partner was in charge of that stuff, and now you find yourself making all the decisions. Maybe you're mad about that. Maybe I am. Nicole from the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast is here to help. She tackles financial literacy by telling the stories of women and widows and finance experts, and shares the lessons they've learned as certified financial planners. Whether you know a lot and feel confident in your financial decisions or feel unsure about all of that stuff, there is more to learn. Listen and subscribe to the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast on all podcast platforms. This ad was paid for by Rockhouse Financial, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
Yeah, you're talking about a phenomenon that I've kind of become more and more aware of, and I think it's actually probably becoming more of an issue, and that's the parasocial relationship, where the person feels like they're in a relationship with a celebrity or somebody who is, you know, visible on the online, or, you know, whatever type of fame that they have, and that person doesn't have a relationship back with you. I remember one of the first podcasts we made, Mel, was after Kobe Bryant was killed, and we were talking about how it was really odd to watch people mourn and have this really big grief response to a person that they didn't know but was still important in their lives, and how that's just a really bizarre feeling. And sometimes it can feel kind of almost like exploitative of the situation, even though for a lot of people, I think they really do have those feelings. But for some people, you're like, it's not even your like loss. And then you're going to come in and tell the widow that they're doing it wrong, you know, for
right.
a person that you don't even have a relationship with,
yeah.
somehow in your brain. It's an odd thing. We live in a weird world, you guys.
We do. I met with Catherine Mayer in London, and Catherine was married to Andy Gill, who was a kind of post-punk band called Gang of Four. And they were, I would say Catherine was one of the most intimidating interviews prior to meeting her. Once I met her, she's lovely, and we had this wonderful time. I was completely jet lagged, but we had a great conversation, and we went down to their basement studio, and he had had produced a lot of music for INXS and you know, several other bands. And so the studio where all of this magic kind of happened was very cool to be there. But she was telling me that, so Andy had been touring in China in early 2012, 2020 and became sick in January of 2020. And they thought that he had pneumonia, but now she believes that he probably had COVID. He was one of the very first cases of COVID. And she was telling me about how, you know, he was in the hospital for weeks and you know, becoming progressively worse. And after he passed away, they let family know, they let band members know, they, you know, kind of got the word out within their small group, and then they announced it publicly. And within a couple days, she received a phone call. She doesn't know how this person found her number, but this person called her and said, "I'm a really big fan of Andy's and Gang of Four, and I'm not doing well, and I just wanted to talk to you."
I'm laughing, but that's also not funny. But
like, really? You're not doing well?
What would your response be to that? Like, "Oh, tell me your name and I'm so sorry. What can I do for you?"
It's so funny because this reminds me of a conversation I used to tour with somebody who was kind of famous in the 90s, a country singer. And when they would do some events where like all of those fans from the 90s would come back, they were insane. And it's like they would have pillowcases with the, you know, the artist faces on them, or they're like, "I have a love nest for it." Like, I would see so many crazy things come through to the artist from fans. And one of our fellow touring acts that was with us was like, "I just want to remind everybody that the word fan is short for fanatic. Keep that in mind." So it's like, people are insane.
It's frightening, you know, sometimes.
I'm super curious, and I wonder if you address this with any of the, and you only interviewed widows, women, right? No widowers?
Yes.
Okay.
No widowers, so, yeah.
I'm super curious to know, and if you guys discuss this at all, if the fact that you were a widow greased some of the wheels for you to be able to meet them. Like, if you would have just been a regular person, they would not have opened up to you. Did some of them actually say that to you?
Yes, absolutely. That we have a connection. And even in my editor, so I'm going through edits right now. The book will be released May 21st of 2024. And so I'm deep in edits right now, but my editor wrote back after I sent him the full manuscript and we made the decision. So I interviewed 22 women and only 14 will be featured in the book. And we will be doing a volume two. So they will appear at some point. But I had sent the manuscript off to him and he was going to get back to me with his decision on which ones were included and then kind of next steps. And it was weeks before I heard from him and I was terrified and thinking, you know, he hates it and he's trying to figure out how to get his advance back and, you know, all of the worst thoughts. And then he sent me a note and he said, it's really wonderful, the connection that you've made with these women. And you can tell that your shared experience is what open the door, and they have told you things that they've maybe never told anyone. And it's going to make for a book that's going to really connect with people, because we do, you know, we always get to the talk about grief and what their grief experience was like. And, you know, kind of what they've taught me is the through line, really, through the book is what I've learned from them about grief. And I've learned something from all of them. So, yeah, but it's definitely, and I would love to get them, you know, my next dream is to get them all in a room and make a documentary film, because they would, you know, I interviewed Gretchen Parsons Carpenter, who was married to Graham Parsons, and, you know, Southern California. He came out of Florida through Nashville and actually Harvard and, you know, ended up in California and started kind of the whole Southern rock, you know, they're like the Eagles kind of came from Graham Parsons, and Graham became best friends with Keith Richards, and Keith wrote a lot about Graham in his book. And so here he meets Gretchen at a party for the Rolling Stones when she's 21. And by the time she's 22, she's off in Paris living with Keith and Anita Pallenberg. And, you know, the four of them are hanging out in this mansion writing music. And Graham was pretty, you know, big influence in the song Wild Horses, and you know, some of the songs that had a little twang to them that the Rolling Stones did shortly after that. And then he was in the Flying Burrito Brothers, and a few other bands, but we got through. So the story of Graham is legend, and it has made for fans that do cross lines a lot. They were kind of separated, but not really. And if you want the whole story on that, you got to read the book. But he went out to Joshua Tree with this, you know, he was going to kind of get clean. And instead, a group of people followed him out there and they partied, and he partied a little too much and he OD'd and he died. And the big legend comes in from the fact that they made plans for him to be buried in New Orleans. And so she was making those plans, getting ready to leave. And his manager stole his body off the tarmac at LAX and took him back to Joshua Tree and lit the body on fire.
What?
Because he said that they had a pact that whichever one went first, there would be no kind of sad funeral. They were going to take care of each other, you know, and who knows what condition they were in when they made this pact or if it even ever happened. But she lived through that trauma at, you know, 24 years old. 24.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's one of the biggest surprises to me of this whole thing, is how young these women were going through this and dealing with money and guitars and, you know, instrument collections and rights and bodies that are stolen.
What are the ranges of age of who you interviewed?
Well, so many, like with Gretchen being, you know, 24, but that was 30 years ago, you know, so most of them are kind of 30s, 40s, 50s, and even a little older at this point, but many were in their 20s when this
wow
happened.
Wow.
So it, you know, just the rock and roll part of it is a lot, but then, you know, to think of living with essentially a heroin addict for the last couple of years, their house burned down, they had all these things happen, and so that has like propelled him into this area of, you know, where it's a lot for her to still deal with. But we got through the interview. It was lovely. And we had lunch and we're at her home, and she did fine the whole time recounting all of this stuff. And she then asked me who else I was interviewing. And I gave her a few names, and I said, this, you know, woman went through this and she was married to this person. And she started crying. And I said, you know, what, I'm sorry, did I say something that, you know, was upsetting? And she said, I can't believe I've gone through this all these years by myself.
Aww.
And I didn't have to.
Aww.
There were others. And I said, you know, I really want to bring all of you together, because you have had these experiences that no one else has experienced. And when you compare notes, it's really, it's really pretty wild.
Their club meetings would be just so insane. I mean, I can't even imagine what they would talk about. Did you have anybody who you contacted who was like, absolutely not, I am not available to talk to you about this?
Yes, yeah. I've had a few.
Yeah.
Donna Allman, married to Greg Allman from the Allman Brothers, wrote me a really lovely, heartbreaking letter that just said, I will not relive that time. You know, he pretty much kind of kicked her out of the house. And she, again, is 22, 23. She had a daughter, and that was it. And, you know, she was kind of getting through that time and getting back on her feet. And then he passed away. And so she's, you know, relived it a couple of times. And she did help her daughter write a book, which is a really wonderful book. Galadriel Allman is her name, and I'm forgetting the title of the book right now, but she said, I, you know, I went through this once helping her, and I will not relive that again. So, you know, there are a couple who have just said no, but mostly it is that it's too traumatic to go through it again, to relive it.
How did this help you with your own grief, with what you've been through?
It certainly gave me a, you know, changed my perspective from here I sit today, not knowing what I'm going to do, to you know, this reason to keep going and to make something out of this. And it really has, you know, it's taken on a life of its own. I think I'll be doing this forever. It's going to, unfortunately, keep happening. And, you know, there will be more women to talk to. And so it really just, it really gave me something to focus on and just talking to them and hearing, you know, experiences where I say, yeah, I had that same experience. I understand. I get it. And it has helped me. I've talked to widows who had to really forgive someone who's no longer here. And so it, you know, it, I had a little bit of that, not much, but, you know, we had the usual kinds of things that Kevin never really accepted that he was dying. So we never had those last conversations. And I had some anger and bitterness around that. But, you know, he did what he needed to do. And Crystal Zivon, who was married to Warren Zivon, who was physically abusive, he then made her write his biography. He made her promise that she'd write his biography. And he left her boxes and boxes of journals. And she said reading those journals was like getting punched in the face all over again. But
oh my gosh.
I also realized that it was his last request for forgiveness from me. And so really, the person who benefits most from that forgiveness is me. So I just forgave him, and now I just love him and miss him. And, wow. You know, I mean, they're powerful, powerful lessons.
I feel like we probably get a little bit of a picture in our mind about why a rock star dies, you know, and I'm sure that it's a lot more nuanced and there's a lot of breadth to it. Like, we just assume that all of them died of drug overdoses or, you know, but there's probably a lot more to those stories. And I'm also sure that the widows have had to deal with some of the judgment from the way that their person died. If it was in fact something like that, that was, I call them dirty deaths, which is a terrible name for them, but there's just clean ways of dying and there's ways that have a lot more baggage. And so some of them did have that and some of them didn't have that. And they probably still had to deal with the assumptions no matter what.
Right, right. Yes, they do. And, you know, a few people come to mind. Scott Weiland from Stone Temple Pilots, I met with his widow, Jamie. And, you know, Scott had been in rehab 14 times. And she is certain that, you know, if he had just lived, that next time was going to be the one that worked. And he died of heart failure. And she'll say, you know, I understand he died of heart failure because he was a heavy smoker and an alcoholic and you know, a heroin user, but he didn't die of an overdose. He didn't, he, you know, and that's very important to her to make that clarification. Same with James Honeyman Scott. He was the lead guitarist of the Pretenders and, you know, 25, and he had a heart condition that they didn't know about. And he went out and partied one night a little too much, but something that anyone else would survive. And so it's heartbreaking for his widow, Sue, when anybody says that it was a drug overdose. It wasn't, it was a heart condition. So yeah, it's very, it's something that does, again, add to the grief, the, you know, having to deal with everything. And yeah, those reputations, and yeah, it's just, it is a lot for them.
Do you think that you're going to stay in the rock star widow world, or do you think you might venture into just in general the music world, like jazz musicians or R&B musicians or other genres?
Right. Yeah. I think I will talk to any widow, and I do have in this book, I have an interview with Nancy Jones, who was married to George Jones. And, you know, you had mentioned Nashville, and let me tell you, those Nashville guys, you know, LA rock and rollers have nothing on those guys in terms of like life and death. And, you know, I also interviewed Lori Morgan, and she'll be in the next version. So she was married to Keith Whitley, and So I've done that a little bit. One of my kind of regrets is that there are no Motown widows in the book. And here I am in Detroit and no Motown widows, but they're all in their 80s and they all tell me they're writing their own books right now.
Yeah.
So
I was going to ask you about that because not only are there great Motown artists, there's the great like recording session players like James Jamerson that made the sound. And so I actually just looked up. I'm like, I wonder if James Jamerson's wife is like, she has passed away, but like Marvin Gaye, so many iconic ones.
Jan Gay and I had some back and forth conversation, and at some point we were going to get together, and then unfortunately she passed away about a year and a half ago. So it's I really want to know those stories too. I mean, they're just but again, they're also difficult, to talk about. So but I would, anyone who wants to talk to me, I will educate myself on the music and be there.
I'll plug you into the jazz scene, people. Yeah, you sent us a photo of the widow of one of my favorite artists, which might be surprising because it's Jim Croce. I love Jim Croce. Like, that's so rad. Tell us about that a little bit.
Oh, that was just a really wonderful interview. And Ingrid and I connected and when I first started this project, and she was very busy and thinking of writing her own book about, she had written a book about Jim, but she wanted to write a book about post Jim, her post Jim life. And so we never quite connected, and she was always on the list. And then I thought, I'll just reach out one more time. And I had, so my first publishing deal, I've also had two publishing deals. The first one was with BMG Books, and they're, a division of BMG, the big, large music conglomerate. And they had decided to do some book publishing. And then as I was getting ready to send everything in and design the cover, they decided they didn't want to be in book publishing anymore. So they closed, and they did help me find my current publisher, which is Backbeat Books. But BMG was able to connect me to many of the widows because they manage the estates of so many musicians. So, and Ingrid was one of those. And so we kind of reconnected and went out to visit her in California. And I will say, and we talk about this in the book. Her son AJ has also talked about this a little bit on his site. So it's it's the first kind of the first announcement of this is going to be in the book, but she is now suffering from aphasia. So it's very difficult for her to speak. And it was a long tough interview. But she's such a lovely person. And it really showed me how much energy we expend in talking and telling stories. And because she can't do that, it was like she just had this in her and she wanted to tell me about it and she couldn't. And so we looked at some journals and some writing she had done earlier on, and she, gave me books and other things that she had done. And so I compiled from that. And then her second husband, Jimmy Rock, was there. And he also he helped her write the biography on Jim. So he was quite knowledgeable and helped out quite a bit in filling things in. And then I sent it off to her after it was written, and she said she cried and she shared it with her sister. And so I feel very good about that. But again, this young, very young widow with a young child, and he's just starting off after they've worked so hard to have a, develop a music career. And then, he has these three big albums that are just huge and number one hit after number one hit, and then calls her one night from the plane, and then the next morning she hears that the plane crashed and he's gone. So, and she went on to a wonderful career in San Diego. They had just moved out there, and she started opening restaurants, and she had a great, a very successful career with Croce's restaurant and jazz club in San Diego. So. Yeah, wonderful, wonderful woman.
Wow. So, Lori, is your book out already?
No, it will be released in May of 2024.
May of 2024. And tell us again what the
Yes.
name is.
So the name is I Can't Remember If I Cried, Rock Widows on Life, Love, and Legacy. And the first line, I Can't Remember If I Cried, comes from a song.
American Pie by Don McLean.
Yep. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride. And
Yeah.
that was about Maria Elena Holly, who is the first rock widow and the widow of Buddy Holly. So it's a little homage to Buddy and Maria Elena. And the whole line is in the book. It's the epigraph in the book.
I have a question about you as a widow, and also maybe about the widows you interviewed. Have you repartnered?
I have not.
That's interesting. How many of the people that you interviewed had repartnered, and how many of them had not?
Most have not. One or two have. Gretchen is remarried. She is married to Bob Carpenter, who is in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. They dated for a couple months before he admitted to her that he was a musician because he knew that she would not go there a second time. So I would say there are maybe three or four of the 14 that have remarried. Not many. And I think it's the combination of a lot of things. For me personally, I've dated. It just hasn't been a priority. And I've always felt that I kind of put this writing thing off to be wife and mom and all of those things. And now I'm doing what I wanted to do when I was 20. So I'm kind of having fun and doing, and I feel very fortunate that I did have that experience, that I, had a marriage that was happy, and I have two really beautiful adult kids and now a daughter-in-law. And so if it happens, great. If I meet someone, that would be wonderful. But I'm doing what I, originally wanted to do. So that's where I'm at.
Will you date a musician?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. She's like, absolutely not. After all these stories
Yeah,
I've told,
right.
wouldn't touch one with a
Well,
10-foot pole.
yeah, and it is, one of the things that has come up is how I thought, I kind of never got my rock star. I got a guy who was, great in many, many ways, but when I was 16, 17, I want to go backstage and have someone fall madly in love and take me on the road, and that would be it. That's the dream you have when you grow up in Detroit. But I had my rock star. He just didn't play guitar.
Oh.
So that's one of the things I learned.
I have a silly hypothetical, like non-consequential question. If you could date any rock star, who would it be?
Any living or dead?
Oh gosh. Let's
So,
do one living and one dead.
okay. Well, so I'll tell you, the pinnacle for widows is Mary Austin, who was the, girlfriend, confidant of Freddie Mercury. She recently, did auction off all of his belongings that she had inherited. And I actually wrote a story that was in Salon about how I understand that she needed to do that. But Freddie is my, oh gosh, I just loved him. I grew up in my first concert, lied to my parents about where I was going, and went to downtown Detroit and saw Queen. And so, that like, and not even date, and just to spend an evening, oh my gosh, talking about music and art and being creative with Freddie Mercury. I can't imagine a better way to spend some time. Living, I'm gonna have to think about that a little
You
bit.
might get a date out of this question if she
I
did.
might, yeah.
Well, who's yours, Mel?
I know my living one. I have two people that are living that I would date if they asked me.
Now I
And
want to
you're gonna
know.
laugh because can everyone please remember that my soul is 97 years old?
I know who one of them
First of
is.
all, number one, Paul McCartney. Number two, Dick Van Dyke.
I knew
Yes, I love him.
it.
Dead, I don't know.
He's like 900 years old, but it's fine.
I love him. Anita, your turn. Who would you date?
Oh, I don't
Jim
know.
Croce.
No, I wouldn't date Jim Croce. I don't know. Because I don't know. Somebody with really great pecs. Just kidding.
Wait, if you, okay, I have someone for you that you could date. They're living. Weird Al. I feel like you guys would have fun together.
My kids just discovered Weird Al, and it's so funny because they are listening to it, and I'm like, I know this song, and they're like, ow. You guys are late to the game, guys. You're late to the game. That's funny. I'll have to think about that and report back because I don't have an
Okay.
answer for you right
Yeah.
now. Lori, I think it's so interesting, and you kind of brought this up in the beginning, but think about how many of the biopics and the books and the, websites that have been written about the performers themselves. And then to think that there are zero that have been written about the people that they left behind. And in a lot of ways, those women were probably responsible for a lot of their success too. They deserve something, don't you think?
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. There's a story that is being left out of the first book, and we're not too certain that it will be in the second book, because the musician, and he's a world musician. He's not quite as well known as some of the others, but there was just a significant scandal, I'll say, in his life, and it has really affected how his widow is able to kind of make her way through the world now. He completely damaged his reputation, and she's left, and then took his life, and she's left to pick up the pieces around that, and it affects everything. She sees his popularity go way down. He left to her a very extensive musical instrument collection, and the value of that has significantly dropped. And that is one of the ways in which these women can sometimes survive, is by selling some of these things. And she had said, I gave up my career to manage him and his career. I put everything into it, and now it's almost like it was all for nothing. And so there's a cost. A lot of times there is a cost. And yeah, I don't know why they have not been asked before for their stories. And sometimes there are biographies. There's a good biography of Stevie Ray Vaughan. Alan Paul wrote that, and he did interview Jana Lapidus. And Jana, again, one of the loveliest, most beautiful women. She was 16 when they met, and they met when he was touring in New Zealand, and he stayed in touch. She was going through a divorce, and so they kind of kept in touch for a while. And then when he almost died, and realized that he had to go into rehab. And the first call he made from rehab was to Jana, and she took off from New Zealand. She was at that point 18, and went to London and was with him for the last 5 years of his life, and not really recognized as his widow because they weren't married and because she was so young. And that's a shame. Like she, the photos, I asked all of them to provide me with photos, and she provided me with just so many beautiful photos of the two of them smiling and so happy. And again, left nothing because there wasn't a will, and she wasn't his wife, and not really considered his widow, which is absolutely wrong. And so, yeah, I'm really thankful to be able to get her story out there.
What's one thing that you have wanted to know about all of their stories? Is there like one question that you like to get out of each of them or just their general story?
I have a series of questions that I make sure to ask each person. Sometimes they're asked just in the course of conversation, and sometimes I come back to them. It's been really interesting to hear about, if they've seen signs, or if they, have felt a presence, and almost all of them have. Some
I
of
feel
them
like
are.
that's so right. I feel like rock stars would definitely still be wanting attention even from the other side.
Right. A lot of like butterflies and birds and, you know, things like that, that kind of show up, and they're, you know, I think they're mindful of that. They kind of look for that. And yeah, so that's always kind of fun and interesting to talk about. So and we always come back to, you know, what have you done since then? And you know, what do you focus on and what got you through, and how have you kind of moved forward? So and a lot of it is keeping up that legacy. You know, that's one of the things that that's very important to someone like Ingrid Croce. As long as she's alive, people are going to know about Jim and his music. And that, you know, again, that's, I installed a park bench for my husband, you know, that has his name on it. And we have a little garden at the local high school, and that's still going. And I feel really proud of myself for having done that. And he'll, you know, kind of be around in our community where we used to live because of that. But these women, like, you know, they're constantly battling with rights and usage and band members who, do they go on? Do they go forward? Do they not? Do they say they won't? You know, Judy Van Zandt, oh my gosh, she is one of my heroes, because, you know, I met her in New Orleans, and we drove up to Gillsburg, Mississippi, and walked the field where the plane crashed, where the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crashed on the anniversary. I called her and said, I'm going to be, you know, in Florida and I'd like to meet with you. And I gave her the dates, and she said, meet me in New Orleans two days before that, and it'll be the anniversary. And there's a huge monument that fans have installed at that field. And she, you know, sat at her dining room table with the other members of the band, and they all said, the band ended with Ronnie. We can't go forward. And they signed a piece of paper and said that, you know, that was true. And then a promoter came along 10 years later and said, you could be making some good money out there on the road. And so they went out on the road. They said, we're just going to do this once, like an anniversary kind of thing, and that'll be it. And then they came back and said, we made a lot of money. And the band, as many bands are, the band was organized as a corporation and everyone owned a share. And Judy had Ronnie's share passed to her. And they had a meeting and they said, we voted you out. You're no longer
As a musician and a widow, I understand some parts of these things, and I'm disappointed in the band, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she took them to court, and it took a couple years, but she won. Yes. And she said, I would sit in that courtroom every day. She said, none of them ever showed up. They sent their attorneys, but I was in that courtroom every day. The judge was going to know, but this meant something to me. And she said, every day I'd go at lunchtime, I'd go in the bathroom and throw up. And then I'd come back. And yeah, but she gets a piece of everything, as she should, you know, and so, yeah.
That's so interesting too, because when you think about like Jason and Scott, their legacy, nobody owns it. You know how like a lot of musicians don't own the rights to their own music, you know, the record labels or whatever own it. So that would be a really interesting thing too, is that you're not actually the owner of your person's legacy. Like how in the, that would be so bizarre and annoying. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. They've all fought with managers and record companies and all of those things, who think, you know, you just go sit over here and we'll take care of the business side of it.
Well, I can't wait for the book to come out. I think it sounds amazing. We should have done this right before the book came out, because now I'm just going to be annoyed that we have to wait so long, but whatever.
I'll come back.
Such is life. Yeah. Such is life.
Yes.
Yeah. Mel.
And yes, we have one more question.
Yeah, I think it's time.
What's your favorite cheese?
Ooh. No.
Have you asked any of your widows that question? And maybe you should.
I have not. We have, you know, we've had some lovely, you know, little dinner things. I sat in this beautiful condo and had a wonderful kind of Italian influenced, you know, not quite dinner, but lots of appetizers and really good wine with Vera Ramone, who was married to Didi Ramone. I say, like, you wouldn't expect that this is what we would do, but now she lives in Florida in this beautiful little condo, and she's just the sweetest
Oh.
person, and told me the whole story So, but gosh, my favorite, geez, I'm gonna say something kind of like a nice brie that has some crusty bread. That would be good. That's my cheese.
I just had a delicious brie a couple nights ago. It was delicious. So, all right.
A little more French than Wisconsin, so.
This is off the topic again too, because I'm going back. You're not supposed to die of squamous cell carcinoma. So what happened there?
Well, so this is very interesting, actually. The skin type of squamous cell is not serious, but
Oh,
the type
okay.
that is in, so his was first found in his lymph nodes, and it didn't start there. So, hollow organs, it can affect the hollow organs. So, and it was known as, head and neck cancer is known as a smoker's and drinker's cancer. And for his dad, who died of it 5 years before he did, if that was the case. But with Kevin, he was neither of those. And he had an occasional beer, but and so they had just done research and discovered just before he was diagnosed that that head and neck cancer, the numbers were going up, and they couldn't figure out why, because smoking numbers were going down. And so they couldn't figure this out. And it was a researcher at Ohio State discovered that it was HPV. So HPV in women causes cervical cancer. In men, it causes head and neck cancer. And all of his tumors, when they were, resected, taken out, they were tested, and they were all HPV positive. So, yeah. And they thought that it was kind of more receptive to treatment, more susceptible to things like chemotherapy, but now they're finding that it really isn't. And so, and he, it was because it had moved once, he was already kind of stage two when it was discovered. They never found out where the primary was. It had grown out of his lymph nodes, so it was already kind of, in his system. And so it was just battle after battle, moved here, then moved there. It was really rough. So from
Now
there
I
it
have
went.
another question for you. Now that you don't have
Okay,
to
sure.
do this earlier or not, I don't know. I'm super curious to know if you feel like your own widowhood story has been squashed because you're telling the widowhood story of so many other people. Do you feel like sometimes yours doesn't have room?
Well, during COVID, when I couldn't do these interviews, because all of the interviews have also been done in person. And so I wasn't doing that during COVID. So I did write a memoir, and I really hope that if the widow book gets traction, that I could sell the memoir. And the memoir is about how our marriage was bookended by 3 years of home renovation, because we bought this crazy abandoned farmhouse and gutted it and then built it back. So 3 years of home renovation at the beginning and 3 years of cancer treatment on the other side. And the chapters alternate back and forth. So it's, yeah, and how we kind of grew up together. And so, yeah, but I mean, who would hear my story? Like somebody will hear my story now because,
Us.
yeah, because of this book. So in that sense, I'm thankful for the book. But otherwise, it's just my kind of local people who know us. It was, yeah, I mean, we had so much support. And I'm also a moth storyteller. So I've been the moth a couple times, and I tell a story about how, in the midst of, he was in the hospital at the end for 45 days. He had become, they moved to the Mets, moved to his spine, and he'd become quadriplegic. And I'm going back and forth every day to the hospital, like two kids at home, and trying to take care of that. And this woman called me and insisted that I was having an affair with her husband. And we finally found out after 3 or 4 days of calling. A friend looked at the caller ID and knew who it was, kind of who it was, that she was like either like the sister of someone we knew from, our kids knew. And So I reached out to that person. I said, you know, your sister's calling me and accusing me of being, you know, having an affair with her husband. You know what our family's going through. You brought us lasagna a few weeks ago. Like, you know, what's going on? And she said, oh, it's not my sister. It's my mother. And what they had found out was that mom had dementia, and she was, they had committed her to a facility, and she was insistent that she was well, but her husband had her committed so he could have an affair. And she could prove it now because she had talked to the woman on the phone. And her phone number was the same as my phone number, except for one digit. So she was misdialing and calling me. But those are the kinds of crazy things that were happening along with, you know, dealing with all of this stuff. And yeah, he received treatment in Bloomington, Indiana, and Chicago, and we were just driving all over. It was intense and just bad.
Well, I hope your story also gets a chance to be told as much as the other people, because you deserve it just as much as they do, even if your husband was a substandard guitarist and not up to the rock star status. <That's right. laughs>
Or but even on the other hand, he never did drugs. So.
And nobody stole his body and burned it in Joshua Tree.
No.
Oh, boy. So there's that. Oh, thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you. Thanks, Mel. And thanks, Anita. Yeah, it's been really wonderful. And thank you for doing this, for getting these stories out there. I've been listening. I caught up. I've listened to all of them and now. And just, wow, these people are doing really fabulous things. So
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
We're all here helping each other help others. Yes. So thank you for what you're doing. We really appreciate it. And I know our listeners appreciate this as well.
So if you want to keep the podcast going, check out our Patreon so we can bring you more stories like Lori's and the stories that she's telling too. That's like third degree widow stories that we're telling now. And if you want to do that, it's patreon.com/WWDN.
If you'd like to buy us tacos, go to buymeacoffee.com/widowwedonow.
And if you just give us a nice rating and review on Apple Podcasts, we also really appreciate that. And we like to read them. So do that too. Check out the Widow Wives Club. Answer all the questions. We have a great time in there. And until I get to talk to you again with Mel, I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
I'm Lori.
And we are just two young widows who are telling stories and another widow who's also telling stories. And we're all just trying to figure out widow.
We
do
now. This is my favorite thing to discuss with you.
Tell me, what is it?
One of my favorite things. I do enjoy tacos and cheese and dogs. This is about how you cannot pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a phone plan, especially when you're a widow, your person is dead, you might have kids, you might need another option, and you just want your phone to work, you want unlimited texting and service, and you want it to be like $25 a month.
It blows my mind that they have plans that start at $15 a month. That is so cheap. And the cool thing is it uses other 5G networks. And so you don't have to pay extra for that. And you still get great service.
Yep. Anita and I have traveled all over and I have used my phone. So I highly recommend it. And my mom's even on it. When my dad died, we put his phone down to the cheapest plan, which is $15 a month. And I think my mom's on the $20 a month plan, and it's so worth it. It's so much cheaper than what we were all paying before. So I highly recommend it if you're on a budget or not. Who cares? Ryan Reynolds is in charge of the company, and they send you free stickers with Ryan Reynolds temporary tattoos. It's kind of the best. So if somebody wants to sign up, what can they do, Anita?
Go to trymintmobile.com/WWDN. Seriously, you guys, such a great idea. Save yourself some money.
And if you're worried about losing data or having any changes with your phone, not going to happen. They walk you through it. Everything's fine. It's the easiest process of all time. Again, that's
trymintmobile.com/WWDN.